No one needs telling that the world's changed a bit in the last 3 or 4 months. And certainly when I look at our utility costs next year, I think they've gone up by something like 5 million. And that inflationary influence pervades everything from the bill costs to the utility costs to the insurance costs to the entire supply chain to people and all the rest of it. So the viability of our sector has definitely got a lot harder.
Hi, I'm Susan Freeman. Welcome back to our Property She podcast series brought to you by Mishcon de Rea in association with the London Real Estate Forum, where I get to interview some of the key influencers in the world of real estate and the built environment. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Rick de Blaby. Rick is CEO of Get Living PLC, the UK's leading investor, developer and operating platform for build-to-rent residential homes, with 4,000 in operation and over 6,000 in pipeline. Get Living's flagship assets and neighbourhoods include East Village at the Olympic Park, Elephant Castle Town Centre, Middlewood Locks in Salford and Lewisham, plus others in Leeds, Glasgow, Birmingham, Leatherhead and Maidenhead. Rick has 40 years of real estate experience with a particular passion for large-scale urban regeneration and neighbourhood creation. His past roles have included CEO of MEPC and United House, and non-exec chairman of Miller Developments. So now, on the 10th anniversary of the Montague Report that marked the start of the UK build-to-rent sector, we're going to hear from Rick de Blaby on what drew him to the sector and what plans he has for Get Living. Rick, good morning and welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we've known each other a few years and in one of your previous incarnations. So let's just start off talking about your real estate backgrounds. And you've worked at Trafalgar House, Countryside, you were CEO at MEPC. And I think only really moved into build to rent when you joined Get Living about 5 years ago. Is that right?
Close. I mean, I certainly spent 10 years at Trafalgar House learning to be a developer. I did 10 years at Countryside Properties, learning how to be the managing director of a division that was a developer. Although by the time we got to about the year 2000, the division at Countryside that I was running morphed into much more of an urban regeneration company that did mixed use. So I guess by then I was seeing and getting involved in more residential development that sat atop of commercial development. As you say, I then was chief executive of MEPC for 10 years. Fantastic fun, really learned how to be, or have the privilege of running big institutional capital on large business parks and science parks and industrial estates across the country. And actually, there was quite a lot about MEPC in terms of the model that was transferable into Get Living. I did do 3 years for private equity, chief exec of a company called United House, which again was really interesting and valuable. And then I'm actually 6 years, Susan, at Get Living, which I have to say has been the best fun to date.
And did you always want to be in real estate? You know, was that your ambition when you started off?
I'm not sure I had a grand plan, but when I look back retrospectively, I did spend quite a lot of my childhood building things. And quite often, if I wasn't building things that looked like houses or larger office buildings, I was quite often drawing them. I thought I wanted to be an architect. I don't think I'd have made a very good architect, as it happens, now knowing the talent and the creativity that you need to be a great architect. But I suppose I've sort of fulfilled that dream in a different way by being able to, you know, very collaboratively, and development involves the collaboration between dozens, hundreds, if not thousands of people, if you include all of the supply chain. I've been able to fulfill my ambitions and dreams by being able to set a brief, set a vision around some of the schemes that I've been very privileged to be part of, and having smart people like architects bring that vision, that realization to fruition. But as I say, it's an incredibly collaborative process, and I feel hugely privileged to have been a part of some of the things that we've all done.
It's a really good way of describing it, because it certainly is collaborative, and you do need all those moving parts to make it work. And this year, I think, is still the 10th anniversary of the Montague Review, which, you know, is seen as marking the start of the UK build-to-rent sector. And of course, East Village, the former Athletes Village, which is one of Get Living's flagship schemes, was effectively the first. I mean, it was a pilot scheme for build-to-rent. So there must have been a huge learning curve there, as it really, I mean, it was the first scale rental scheme in the UK. And I mean, I never remember, because at Mishcons, we were very much involved in creating the scheme. And it was really a question of, you know, saying, well, gosh, you know, nobody's done this for decades. You know, how do we set it up? How do we set up the service charge? How do we deal with VAT? But there must have been some incredible learnings. And in fact, you're probably still learning, because, you know, the whole sector is still evolving.
Well, look, the Montague Review certainly had a vision, and I think it's to be applauded about how quickly that vision was realised in terms of, I guess, firing the starting gun for the build-to-rent sector in the UK. I mean, that vision to create the UK's first big rental community, you know, sat with people like Jamie Riplett and Stafford Lancaster at Delancey, and the team around that, obviously with QD money coming in to support it. And yeah, certainly East Village has gone through a few eras. There was that first era about how you set it up and all the things that you mentioned that, say, Mishcon were very much a part of. You get an era where the first residents move in. You know, inevitably there tend to be a cohort of more pioneering, sometimes more transient people. It then sort of settles down, and you get people who go, right, okay, the location's established, I understand what it is, and you get what was then actually a predominantly millennial audience move in. You get another era after that, actually, when people really do start to put down roots, and you can really feel that community, that neighborhood really starting to form. And I, you know, I often say, when I'm talking about Get Living, we don't really create that neighborhood. We create the stage in which the people who live there have the ability to create their community, their neighborhood. But that was certainly another era where that started to happen. And of course, the place, you know, becomes full, and you get all of the retail and amenities working in that sort of ground floor. The public realm starts to be populated with people, and it really feels like a place. And then you move into another era where the people who've put down the roots, they start to form partnerships. And what we're seeing right now, there are a lot of prams whizzing around in East Village. And that itself brings another dimension. And of course, you know, we've got an Ofsted outstanding school in East Village as well. So there's always been a lot of children up to the age of 18 present. But that thing of when people form those relationships and they start to build their families, I like to think it's a real endorsement of what East Village always set out to be, which was this incredibly vibrant, safe, rich neighborhood. And it's, you know, it's very fulfilling for everyone at Get Living to see that happen. There's another stage coming up, I suspect, where you'll see some of the seniors move into East Village, you know, maybe the grandparents of those small children. And at the same time, you know, those small children in 5-10 years' time become teenagers. And again, you get a different dynamic, a different vibe into the village. And whenever we're thinking about, you know, the next phase of development, and we've still got a couple of phases to go. Student block of about 500 homes for London College of Fashion students, because London College of Fashion building a new university on East Bank, and then another 850, 900 homes on the final plot. You've got to really think about what those lifestyle preferences are in 4/5 years' time and beyond, going up 10, 15 years' time. How that public realm really needs to work, how people's changing lifestyles, preferences are going to play out, which, you know, have been accelerated somewhat over the last 3 years post-pandemic around well-being or work at home, preference for more amenities and so on. So as you say, you never stop learning. It requires you to be, I think, a great listener, a great spotter of trends, got to be a great researcher, a great analyst. Most of all, you've got to be a great collaborator, you know, because East Village does exist incredibly interdependently, symbiotically, with all of the things that are now going on in that part of the world.
And it's interesting, as you say, that the age demographics are changing, because a lot of the built-to-rent schemes initially seem to be aimed at the younger generation, not necessarily the seniors, as you've mentioned. And so the idea of everybody sort of mixing in together is a fascinating one. I mean, do you think that will work if you start to get seniors coming in? Will they coexist happily with your younger pram pushing generation?
I do, yes. But, you know, I think it's easy to say to sort of group all of the seniors or whatever nomenclature we give them into one group. And it's not that. I think the sort of people that we might target are those ones where, you know, they're drawn to city life. They're drawn to live with a whole wide variety and demographic of population, people who want that richness, that culture, the easy transportation and so on. Now, that's not for everyone of a certain age. That's for a certain group of people, you know, people who quite happily lock the door and go traveling for a month or whatever. But I mean, what I'd say in addition, Susan, is that there's a bit of a fallacy that, you know, these types of built-to-rent schemes, these types of neighbourhoods are just full of, you know, affluent millennials that work in insurance and banking and law and accountancy and so on. I mean, it often surprises people that one of the most referenced employers we have at East Village is the NHS. And we have, you know, plenty of public sector workers, obviously private sector workers. We have a lot of entrepreneurs who've set up their own businesses, work at home or work locally. Inevitably, yes, you know, a decent number of people work in Canary Wharf or work in the city, but it's certainly not a monoculture by any means. And when we think about Elephant and Castle and we look at what we've got in Manchester and then the other six neighbourhoods that we're building up around the country, I'm sure it will be populated by people of an increasingly wide demographic background, field of work and so on.
And would you say that rental is now a lifestyle choice for the people that you have in your communities? Because that's something that government has been sort of quite slow to pick up at. And, you know, every year the housing minister comes to the Property Week RESI conference and, you know, there's a speech, talks about for sale housing, doesn't mention build to rent. And then, you know, there's a question about build to rent and it becomes clear that the housing minister actually doesn't necessarily know what build to rent is. Is that going to change, do you think?
I do, yeah. I mean, look, there's certainly an aspiration for plenty of people to own their own home. And, you know, who would argue against that? But for a very large number of people who, for now, can't either afford to own their home or positively choose not to own their own home because they want the mobility and they want the flexibility, and who don't qualify for affordable housing for whatever reason, that rental sector plays a huge role in our housing market in the UK. Now, you know, for the most part, that rental housing is provided by your buy-to-let mum and pop investors, but they are exiting the market steadily and surely. And the built-to-rent market is still a very nascent sector, probably less than 2% of the housing stock at the moment. But if you look at the weight of capital that's trying to come into the sector to try and solve a part of our housing challenges, yes, the sector on every piece of research that you see from any of the big houses is set to grow very significantly. And, you know, it was always part of our vision to address the challenges that renters have, because if you took a typical vox pop 10 years ago when East Village was set up, you would have heard refrains around insecurity of tenure, indiscriminate rent increases, big fees, security deposits, poor repair service, absentee landlord, all of that stuff. And we very much set out to disrupt that and say, well, you can have security of tenure. The rent increases will be annual. We won't take fees. We'll be very measured in the security deposit. And if you pass certain referencing, no deposit. We're there 24/7. You pay one subscription a month, and we fix everything else. And that certainly resonated with the audience that you know, we're targeting that proposition at. Now, I think our vision, our propositions moved up on significantly from that, because that did talk to the transaction of coming in and renting a home. I think where we're at now is that it's much more about the experience and the opportunity we give people to live the life they want to build for themselves. Because when I look at a lot of people that first come into our neighborhood, you know, the people quite often that have come from overseas, or they've come from other geographies that aren't in London or Manchester. And that thing about, it can be very lonely when you first move into somewhere you've never lived in before. And I think we're really beginning to see our proposition being about not just a great home and a great public realm and that sort of exemplary level of service, but it's really a story about togetherness and how you make friends and put down roots and, as I say, explore and build the life that you want for yourself. And if you know that you may move job, you may move geography, you may form those relationships and want to upsize and indeed build a family, then part of our proposition has to address that desire to stay in one place, but to be able to move around and have that flexibility.
How long on average do your occupiers stay with you?
It's lengthening all the time. It's probably approaching 3 years now. But that's an average. It's a bit like a cricket score. There are a lot of not outs in that, if you know what I mean. And I would expect it to continue to grow in that respect.
And in terms of community activities, do you provide the activities, or do your residents sort of get together and decide what they want and run their own activities?
Yeah, good question. We used to do set up a lot. Well, if I take East Village, I think we will have done something like 48 events this year. So there's always stuff going on. If I look back at the early days, we generally did quite big staged events. And I think we learned in the end that that probably wasn't what people really wanted. And it's become a program of events that are smaller and more targeted. Because if you live in East Village, you won't go to 48 events a year. You might go to 8 or 10, but there'll be the 8 or 10 that really interest you. And I think where we are much more now is that we create the opportunity for these events to happen, but a lot of the residents take the ownership of actually making their own clubs, their own groups, and staging a lot of their own events in the buildings or the spaces that we can provide. And that's actually much more durable, much more successful.
Sounds like a very, very nice way to live, actually. And, you know, because you hear about people being, you know, being lonely, especially when they sort of first come to a city, and there you've got, you know, as much social life as you want, which sounds very attractive.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think our people come to work with real sense of purpose. You know, the biggest direct debit our residents make in a month generally comes to us. And remember, they can break their lease on 2 months' notice. So if they don't think they're getting a great experience, a great home, a great service, they can vote with their feet. And that, you know, instills in us a real culture of customer care and making sure that we do our best every day for everybody. Happily, our Google scores reflect that. You know, they're in the high fours. But you have to work very hard to keep your Google scores up there. And, you know, in a world of social media, if we get something wrong or people don't like what we do, of course, you know, they're very vocal and you can see it very quickly.
Yes, it's almost instantaneous, isn't it? And have you had sort of what you regard as a sort of, you know, bad renting experience, something that went wrong that you just hadn't foreseen and it just didn't work?
Look, we make mistakes like everybody. You know, the tricks to learn from the mistakes. I like to think, you know, in the 8,000 people and rising that we currently accommodate, and I say rising because it's going to pretty quickly get to probably 16 or 20,000, you get the odd thing wrong, but I don't think we make too many mistakes. But, you know, where does it go wrong? Sometimes it's a miscommunication. Sometimes you get the odd technology glitch. Sometimes, you know, buildings themselves fail in some way, whether it's a power outage or it's a leak or whatever. It happens. But I think what we've learned is that where we do make a mistake, if you're honest about that and you fix it well and you look after your resident and they feel that they've been courteously and genuinely and authentically respected and dealt with, actually you can build advocacy.
And it really is hospitality, isn't it? As sort of hearing you talk about it, it seems less, you know, traditional real estate and more, you know, some hospitality sector.
Yeah, we do have those conversations, and there are days when it can feel like a real estate business, obviously, because it's £3 billion worth of real estate. There are certainly days when it feels like a lifestyle experience hospitality company. And I guess it depends which team you're in within Get Living as to which is the predominant sense on any one particular day. But it's a combination of all of those. And look, I don't think we're unusual in that, because you can look at a lot of real estate classes and asset classes these days, and a lot of them, if they're going to perform well for the investors that put up the capital to make them what they are, have to have that operational platform overlay on top. And it's not just our sector that's like that. I just think that in a B2C world rather than a B2B world, you probably just have to be even more on your game.
Yeah, it's absolutely right about the sort of operational side and affecting other sectors like offices as well. And in terms of Get Living's expansion plans, you've moved into the commuter belt with Maidenhead. Obviously, you are in various locations outside of London now. How are you looking to expand the business?
Well, look, it's really exciting. And when we started with East Village, as you said, Elephant and Castle was number two, but we're rebuilding the town centre. Everyone will remember the Elephant and Castle town centre. So there's a huge redevelopment going on there. And that's actually a third phase Elephant. The third neighbourhood that we acquired was Newmaker Yards in Salford, just on the other side of the River Irwell to Manchester city centre. And we, you know, certainly had an ambition to get a footprint in all of the major regional cities. So we bought land in Leeds and Glasgow. We've got a big scheme in Birmingham. We then did another one in London in Lewisham. And to your commuter belt reference, we've got an aspiration to build a necklace of similar neighbourhoods around commutable London. And it started with Maidenhead, obviously on Crossrail, the Elizabeth line. We did one a few months ago in Leatherhead, and we'll continue to try and build that necklace around those commuter areas of London, which have, you know, come into their own, because hybrid working has certainly meant that not everyone comes into work 5 days a week. And certainly when you look at those M25 locations, of course, not everyone works in London. There's plenty of employment going on that orbital motorway. So I think there's real possibilities for us to build that up.
And with the hybrid working, as you mentioned, is that affecting the way you design your communities? Are you having to put in more workspace for people?
Yeah. I mean, that discussion about the right level of amenity is a very live discussion, because you've got to balance what people want and what they genuinely use. And certainly things like work from home is highly relevant at the moment. Now, I say work from home, not everyone wants to work in the home, but they do want to work in the neighborhood. So we're certainly having to, you know, convert some of our spaces to provide that work from home facility. But, you know, the industry is got the real challenge of what people colloquially call the leakage, the gross income to the NOI. We express it as cost per unit. And, you know, I've certainly seen some of our competitors put in swimming pools and tennis courts and all the rest of it. It'd be interesting to see in a year or two how much they've been used. But the cost of producing that stuff and managing it is enormous, of course. And I think we, all our peers and us, are sort of trying to discover where the optimum lies between what people want, what they value, and what we can affordably provide.
Yes, that must be particularly difficult at the moment with rising costs on all fronts, rising energy costs. The actual cost of providing those amenities is just forever going up.
Yeah. Well, look, no one needs telling that the world's changed a bit in the last 3 or 4 months. And certainly when I look at our utility costs next year, I think they've gone up by something like 5 million. And that inflationary influence pervades everything from the bill costs to the utility costs to the insurance costs to the entire supply chain to people and all the rest of it. So there are certainly some real challenges around that. And of course, the debt costs for everybody who's got a refinancing event or is looking to finance their first development are also pretty challenging. So the viability of our sector has definitely got a lot harder. Yes, there's been some revenue growth, but that's largely a correction from the COVID era. And I think that will start to subdue, but it'll still be pegged us to wage growth because it generally is. You know, the bank of mum and dad doesn't really apply in our world. People have a salary and they can afford to pay X percent in terms of rent and running costs. So, there are definitely viability challenges for delivering a lot of the pipeline, which may have been consented already or for which planning permissions are in there. And we'll have to see how that shakes out.
And ideally, what sort of sites are you looking for at the moment?
Well, we really like scale. And I think we are probably, we differentiate ourselves by that. So if you look at all of the assets we've got, they are generally the larger footprints, the larger number of homes with the most variety. So doing a scheme of, 150, 200 homes in a single block on a postage stamp site is not us. We like to be able to have that realm, that sense of place, that scale that we can put a team on site that's there 24/7 to handle any resident customer needs. And I think that enables you to really differentiate your proposition to residents because you have to answer the so what. So we have big neighborhoods, but if I'm talking to you, why would you, Susan, choose to live in a Get Living home, one of our big neighborhoods, compared to an identical one or two bed home that's on the other side of our red line? And that's really a proposition around the fact that we can provide real value. You're part of that neighborhood. You've got the amenities. You've got us on site to deal with it. It's very safe. We spend a lot of money, millions a year on security. We're generally around areas of great public transport. And it's that soft side, that experience side, where the benefits of scale really come to you as a resident.
And would you sort of generally be building on your own, or would you do it in joint venture, or does it vary from scheme to scheme?
Yeah, good question. I mean, we're pretty agnostic about the way we get our opportunities. So some of the schemes we've bought land and arranged our own planning and got our own contractor and built the whole thing through, taking all of the risk of the developer all the way through to the operation. One or two have been on a forward commitment where the building's already started and we've said effectively we will buy on completion. A lot have been done through forward funding where developers have come to us and said, we've got the land, we've got the planning permission, will you forward fund the scheme from inception to completion? And we've certainly done that. Joint ventures, yes, is another route. You know, the sort of scale that we want in the locations that we want, they're not growing on trees. You have to be really selective and pretty energized about how you go about finding that pipeline. So as I said at the start, you have to be pretty agnostic about how you're going to get there. What matters to us is the quality of the architecture, the quality of the homes, the quality of the realm that we can create, and the footprint and the neighborhood and the general vibe that we can get to in the end.
And when Build to Rent sort of kicked off initially 10 years ago, the UK funds were quite slow to invest back into residential and to invest in Build to Rent. I mean, we're hearing some quite a lot about, you know, possibility of sort of rent controls and rent caps and, you know, this sort of thing. I mean, is this something that you're concerned about and something you think that the funds are concerned about?
Well, I think there is still seems to be a huge weight of capital trying to get into the sector, because everyone can look into the UK and say we've got a structural shortage of housing, structural shortage of professionally run rental housing. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon with the planning regime that we have and the relatively densely populated country that we are with a relatively scarce supply of land. So I don't think that's going to change. To your question about rent controls, is it a threat to the sector? I think there's a possibility that rent control of some sort or another might be imposed in the next few years. Of course, you can see the political attraction of doing that from the point of view of protecting the resident, but it has a whole suite of unintended consequences, because it could turn off some investors if they think their revenue in their financial model is going to be capped, because they themselves, you know, are part of a much wider ecosystem where they themselves have their own pensioners and their own liabilities to meet and the rest of it. It actually reduces the mobility of people to move around, because if you are in a rent-controlled apartment, you'll probably stick with it, and therefore it removes that mobility. It actually probably reduces the incentive for the owners to keep the property in a really great state of repair. You know, every time someone moves out of our apartment, we're redecorating it, refreshing it. It's practically new when the next person comes in. And you can see in other markets, there's a bit of a black market that emerges, because people are effectively selling their position of the discounted rent. So you can see the political attraction of it, but I think it does have a suite of unintended consequences that in the end will compress the future supply. And the best answer to keep the rents affordable and realistic is actually to have a proper demand supply balance. And we don't have that at the moment. But I think there's always an upside to these things, because we're probably entering a period, for all of the reasons around inflation and higher exit yields and higher debt costs and higher cost per unit and stuff, where there will be some consolidation in the sector. And if the rent controls come in, that's another influence on that. And I think if we can get living into a place where it's operating just supremely efficiently, when it's got the product that people really want, when it's got a proposition that really resonates, I think there's an opportunity for us to be the consolidator. And if the rules of the game involve some rent regulation, well, that just goes to price and we'll have to work with it. But that's not to say I think it's a good idea, because I think it will have consequences in the wider provision of housing across the UK.
Yes, and I think historically it hasn't worked. And you've touched on, you know, the question of supply and demand. How are you finding demand at the moment? I mean, people seem to want the type of accommodation that Get Living are providing. And how are occupancy levels? I mean,
well, demand's very high, and our occupancy levels are in the 98% plus. Elephant regularly has weeks where it's 100%. It's actually very hard to be 100% where, you know, everybody's with a head on every pillow. So demand is very high for sure. And again, for the reasons I've said, I'm not sure that's going to change particularly.
And did that, as a matter of interest, I mean, during COVID lockdown, did demand hold up, and were people able to pay their rent?
So if you go back to March 20 and that first period of lockdown, so what was it, sort of late May, wasn't it? I think what we saw there was that most students, most overseas students just went home. So you certainly lost that cohort of occupancy. Most of the younger people that were furloughed went back to the dining room at mum and dad's. We were still bringing quite a lot of people in terms of move-ins, because you have to remember there were plenty of people that served notice to leave their own rental homes in January and February, counting on us to be able to move them in March, April and May. So we certainly had people who were in the office still being able to move people into their homes in a Get Living neighborhood. But we did lose occupancy in that period, like everybody else. What happened after that COVID lockdown period, that first one? We had quite a lot of people defect, actually, from the 21st floor of a tall building with no balcony that were coming to places like East Village and New Maker in Manchester and Elephant, because they liked the public realm. They liked the fact that we still had teams on site. They liked the fact that there was a neighborhood and there was a community feel. And actually, our occupancy bounced back really quite quickly on the latter part of 2020. And we got to a place in 2021 where we were back in those very high 90s occupancy. And it was, I think, a validation of our big scale neighborhoods compared to our peers.
And what would you say are the sort of greatest business challenges for you sort of at the moment?
You know, when I sort of run up and down the line pretty much on a daily basis, you know, building a great team has taken a while, but I'm really proud of the team that we've got these days. I'm really proud of the commitment that everyone brings to work. I'm really proud of the purpose everyone feels. I'm really proud of the cognitive diversity that we've got around the place. Finding your pipeline is definitely a challenge. And when you found it, being able to build it on a viable basis is a challenge. Getting planning, as everybody knows, has probably never been harder. Keeping your proposition fresh all the time and knowing your target audience and really what they want is something you always have to work at. There's a whole world behind the veil of processes and controls and good governance and making sure that the machine operates really efficiently. And a lot of that goes to the tech stack that you can build in your operation. And that's a continuum as well, because as you grow and as technology changes and as you're in that relentless pursuit for real operational efficiency that manifests itself in a great resident experience, you've got to work at that all of the time. And, you know, on the sort of income yields that we operate in, it's a pretty asymmetric equation, because if you get everything right, you can move the total return up by a few bips. You don't have to get many things wrong for it to really fall away. So it's not sort of episodic in the way that some commercial property businesses are. It's like an ultra marathon. You've got to be on your game every day. So there's definitely challenges around that. But if you were asking me, you know, what keeps me awake at night, it's really how we consistently deliver a great resident experience, how we consistently deliver an outperforming total return for our investors, how we consistently make sure that our team are engaged and collaborating and feeling great, and then how we grow our pipeline, because you want your pipeline and your growth to be accretive to those returns and actually accretive to the resident proposition that you're giving.
So you mentioned technology, and I was just wondering how important great technology is to the operation of the business now.
It's increasingly important. You know, technology has to serve a number of areas. So, you know, you want technology to provide a great resident experience, as I say. So people can go on the app. They can go, I mean, they start on the website, apply for a home, and they sort of self-qualify. They can view the home online. They can arrange the viewing to see it for real online. They can make payments online. They can find out what events are going on online. I mean, they just need to be able to get on the app and communicate with us really effectively. Tech has to work for all of your finance functions, your accounts receivable, your accounts payable. It's really important for FP&A, it's really important for your data analytics. You know, we're increasingly moving to a position where the data drives the decision-making, the pricing, and all the rest of it. You know, the technology works in terms of your operating model, and actually being able to do it in a very formulaic, cookie cutter way again and again and again and again without it falling over. And technology helps us in terms of the way we target our proposition to the audience we're really trying to connect to. So it's critical in a number of ways. And we've got a pretty good tech stack. I was probably telling the investors 2 years ago that it was absolutely brilliant and class leading, but these things need refreshing, touching up, tuning every 6 months. We happen to be at a moment in time for us where some of our software contracts are coming up for grabs. We are at that point of inflection where we're moving from 3 neighborhoods to 4 next year to up to 9 that we've secured now. So you've got to find a way to be operationally more efficient, and technology is a key facilitator of that.
And you were talking about consistently delivering for your investors, and at the beginning of the conversation you were talking about, you know, how Get Living started with Qatari DR. Can you tell us a little bit about who the investors are in the Get Living business?
Yeah, we've got 3 investors: APG, big Dutch pension fund, the Qataris, as you say, albeit they're in a process at the moment, and we may have a new investor in there shortly. And then there is a fund called DOR, Delancey Oxford Residential. So that is some of Delancey Oxford Properties, obviously part of the OMERS group. And within the DOR fund itself are 3 other passive institutional investors. So it's a club of 3. We're listed on the International Stock Exchange in Jersey as a REIT. But if I look forward and we grow, then who knows where that will go? I mean, I think it's part of our job as the executive team of Get Living to give investors the optionality around widening the club, an IPO, whatever it is. But I think at the ambition and the scale that we're trying to get to, we're definitely going to need considerably more equity capital, and obviously the debt that sits alongside that. And it's for those shareholders to decide whether they want to keep adding more equity into it or whether they wish to bring in other partners to sit alongside them.
And in terms of developing the Get Living brand, you know, how do you see that? You know, do you have thoughts about rolling out the brand outside the UK, sort of extending the ambit of the brand further?
Possibly. I think we've got to get a higher level of footprint, a higher level of scale in the UK at the moment. So our focus absolutely has to be on that. We have looked at Dublin in the past. We didn't succeed at the time. We've obviously got the position in Glasgow, in Scotland, which has a different regime, brought in rent controls, interestingly enough, pretty recently. But, you know, we're busy building another 6,500 homes right now, today. We're certainly screening new opportunities all the time. So I think it's a UK business for now, but at a certain point, who knows?
And I mean, one of the things that I as a wonder about, if you look at the multifamily operations in the States, they tend to divide the development function and the operator function. I mean, do you see that something that could happen in the UK?
Well, of course, the businesses that operate in the United States make us look like minnows.
At the moment.
At the moment. And that tells you something, because I think inevitably, you know, the UK will see a group of bigger scale businesses like ours really establish themselves. So we're still very nascent, but we will become mainstream quite quickly. To your point about separating the development from the operation, we've chosen not to do that, because I think when you're developing your next neighborhood, you want your development team to be very close to your neighborhood team, because your neighborhood team, who are doing the leasing, who are doing the renewals, have those relationships with residents, your repairs and maintenance teams who know, you know, what taps start to leak, what wardrobes start to creak. You want that constant feedback loop from the people who are at the coalface feeding into your development team, so that they're not just looking at it from a development appraisal point of view, where effectively they've crystallized their profit on practical completion. because ours is a long-term business, and the decisions we make 3 years before practical completion absolutely influence the cost per unit, the attractiveness of the homes, the revenue, the stickiness of the resident, and so on. So you need your development team and your operational team to be absolutely hand in glove all the way. And, you know, as we look forward now, that whole ESG net zero carbon agenda is a huge part of how we wish to develop in future. And when you're looking at an agenda like that, you can be quite disruptive about your new developments. You actually have to be quite adaptive in terms of the portfolio that you've already got. But that doesn't mean to say that you can't take your existing portfolio and move it up that ESG and that net zero carbon agenda. So your development team is a really key part of how they relate to the operation. So keeping them apart, not what we've chosen to do.
And in terms of the sustainability agenda, I mean, presumably that requires collaboration with the residents as well. If, you know, one's talking about keeping sort of energy consumption down, everybody has to want to do it.
Really good point. I mean, there are certain things that we can do on our own, and we, you know, are benchmarked against the GRESB index. Got a 5-star rating, by the way. I can brag about that. And there's the whole TCFD, which you'll know all about, which, you know, we're required to report against, I think, from the back end of 2024. But you're right. In the end, if you're going to be successful in your ESG aspirations, if you're going to be energy efficient, if you're going to reduce your carbon footprint, there has to be real alignment. There's got to be a real shared mission between resident and building owner. And we're very much thinking about that in terms of how we refresh and re-articulate our proposition. Because at the moment, you know, if you're building a city office, if you're not BREEAM outstanding, you're not really in the game. At the moment, in our world, residents, it's not the first question they ask us, you know, what's our ESG, what's our net zero carbon, what's our carbon footprint, and so on. But we really want them to be asking those questions because it's a differentiator for us. And we really want them to stand alongside us, shoulder to shoulder, to advance that agenda because it's in our mutual interest to do so.
It's actually quite surprising that they're not, because I would have thought with your sort of younger demographic that it is the actual sustainability and, you know, all these things are questions they would be asking when they move in.
You're right. And they are starting to ask that. I mean, they certainly ask about recycling and so on. Our employees come to us and say, what's our agenda on that before they start joining us? So it's definitely got that far. But it's a two-way thing, isn't it? I mean, I think if we can articulate a proposition to a prospective resident that says, look, this is what we're doing. We're trying to be a force for good in the world. Join our mission and be part of that. Then you're stimulating that interest, that motivation to do that stuff.
And in terms of the S in the ESG, the sort of social impact side, is that something that Get Living gets involved in terms of community events and actually, you know, building some relationships with people outside the actual Get Living community?
Big time. You know, if you are a long-term owner of the sort of neighborhoods that we have, you really have the responsibility to deliver social value, be a force for good in those communities that you live in. Because as I said earlier, you know, we exist very symbiotically with the people that employ, the people that are part of the civic group. You really have to be part and earn your right to be part of that civic family in whatever geography that you happen to be in. And one of the ways that is manifested is in the social value that we deliver. And that takes all sorts of forms from, you know, the charities that we sponsor, the local artists that we sponsor, a lot of the sporting endeavors. And you know, you just go into these new geographies and you invite the community to come forward and say, well, what is it that you're trying to achieve? What is it that we can help participate in? And, you know, the people who work at Get Living love being part of that.
And in 5 years' time, Rick, if we were having this conversation, where would you like Get Living to be in terms of, you know, achievement, size, number of residents?
I really want Get Living to be that exemplar, that provider of homes for people to really thrive and flourish and be together. And that leaves you thinking about, so how do we do that? And it's partly about scale, because if you can build these big neighborhoods in lots of places around the UK, that enables you to be smarter. It enables you to deliver a better proposition. It enables you to get better value. It enables you to do it better and better. So there's certainly a scale point to that. All the time, we're having to compete for capital to do that. So we've got to be profitable and operationally efficient so that we're delivering an acceptable pension fund return. You need a great team to do it. So all the time, you've got to be sure that you're giving people who come here a real sense of purpose, a real fulfilling career with opportunities to grow. And there is an opportunity for, you know, the best in the sector to emerge to be that. I just want to be the best of that cohort.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great place to end. That's brilliant, Rick. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Well, again, thank you for having me, Susan. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Rick de Blaby, for talking to us about what Get Living and the build-to-rent sector have achieved in 10 years and what we may expect from the sector going forward. So that's it for now. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please join us for the next Property She podcast interview coming very soon. The Property She podcast is brought to you by Mishcon de Rea in association with the London Real Estate Forum and can be found at mishcon.com/propertyshe, along with all our interviews and programme notes. The podcasts are also available to subscribe to on your Apple Podcast app and on Spotify and whatever podcast app you use. Do continue to subscribe and let us have your feedback and comments, and most importantly, suggestions for future guests. And of course, you can continue to follow me on Twitter at PropertyShe and on LinkedIn for a very regular commentary on all things real estate, prop tech, and the built environment.